conciliatory tone. "Not even the cleverest spy can learn aught from an empty room. His Highness sent everyone away at once, save the princess and me."
"Sent them away! If that is to be his habit, you'll be of small use to me."
"Nay, wait! It will not always be so." Really frightened now, Mara groped for an idea. No use to him. If he thought that, he might sell her tomorrow. Her mind full of unpleasantly vivid images. Baskets of unironed shenties, shelves of forbidden food, the bite of a lash. She put all her persuasiveness into her voice. "Give me a little longer. It will not be thus always. The king cleared the room only because the barbarian was ill at ease. Next time, I promise, no such thing will happen. I'll see to it myself. I can lead that maiden where I will..."
"So you say,"
he remarked. He was appraising her coldly and with doubt. "I swear it. Only let me show you." He was silent a moment, drumming his fingertips on the arms of his chair.
"So they all left the room. Even the scribe?"
"Aye, the scribe too."
"The hefts take their souls,"
he said with a quiet malevolence that chilled Mara's blood.
"Hand-picked, every one of them. Yet the fools are afraid of him. And someone's bearing messages."
"They're all spies, then," Mara thought. "The guards, the scribe, especially the scribe. I must be careful of him." Warily, she watched her master's granite face. The harsh line of his brow and nose waked a flicker of recognition in her, but she could not place what it reminded her of. Possibly some statue of a devil god in the temple at Menfi, she thought sardonically. Surely no other human had such a countenance. Who was he, anyhow? Someone who ranked high with the queen, for he had stood close to the throne this morning. Not so close as Sheftu, however. Only Count Senmut himself stood closer than Sheftu. Her master stirred in his chair.
"Perhaps I will give you one more chance. You think you can prevent Thutmose from clearing the room?"
"I will do my best, master. Only try me. I'll..."
"I see little else to do. I will try you."
He shot a venomous glance at her.
"And I will know if you fail. Now listen, I realize you cannot discover the leaders of this accursed plot, but with any wit, you can find their messenger or some news of where they meet. I'm in haste, as I think I've made clear."
Thoughtfully, he added,
"And keep me a watch on the scribe."
"With pleasure, master." "He will also," she reflected, "instruct the scribe to keep a watch on me."
"Very well, then we are done. You have your chance. I trust you will make good use of it. It would be unfortunate if you should disappoint me again."
He clapped his hands and the Libyan appeared at the door. Muffling herself in her cloak, Mara hastened to follow him into the hall and out once more to the waiting chariot. Even the surly Shahzar was better company than that crocodile in there. On the ride back to the palace, the pace was as headlong as before, but Mara had learned better how to brace herself for it. And on this trip, something happened that furnished her considerable enlightenment. At the main gate of the palace grounds, the sentries had been changed, and the new one was apparently skeptical about Shahzar's credentials. There was a muttered argument growing rapidly angrier on both sides. Finally, Shahzar leaned half out of the chariot, brandishing his whip.
"Fool and idiot! If you do not know the scarab, I'll wager you'll stand aside at my master's name, Nehere, the brother of Senmut. Now hold your tongue about it, but let me pass."
It was the end of the argument, but Mara scarcely noticed the lurch as they plunged forward once again. So Lord Nehere was her master. own brother to Senmut, the architect, he of the deep-etched smile and avaricious eyes who stood nearest Hatshepsut and her throne. It was easy now to place that fleeting resemblance to someone she had noticed in her master's face. It was no stone devil god, but Count Senmut, whose nose and brow traced the same harsh angle. In Amun's name, what hornet's nest had she walked into that day in Menfi? Sheftu, the queen, the king, and now two devils instead of one to scheme with and lie to and walk in fear of. It would have been less complicated to stay a slave and iron shenties all her days. At the moment, her future did not seem half so pleasant and certain as it had this morning. And tomorrow night was beginning to loom in her mind again. Might it please Amun to make that sentry susceptible to blue eyes? At least, reflected Mara, as at last she climbed the stairs to the welcome solitude of her own room, life was no longer in any danger of becoming monotonous. Part 4. The Inn. Chapter 12. The Sentry at the Gate. It was the next night. The sun had dropped into the hills behind Hatshepsut's temple 3 hours since, and the late moon had not yet risen. The palace driveway, known as the Road of the Rams, was shrouded in darkness. Near the tall bronze doors at the end of the drive, a torch sputtered and smoked in its bracket, shedding its orange light down upon the sentry who lounged, yawning, below it. Mara, concealed in the shadowy gateway leading to the Court of the Weavers, had been watching him for some moments. He was the same who had grinned at her last night when she passed through with Anani. So far, so good. But had his mood changed? Perhaps tonight he would be surly if he had lost at his gaming with the stable boys or been reprimanded by his captain for some mistake or other. Well, it was a chance she had to take. Glancing behind her once more to make sure the Court of the Weavers was as empty as the drive, she wrapped the folds of her cloak half over her face and began to sob softly. After a moment, the guard became aware of the sound. She could hear the faint clatter of his sword as he straightened and prayed Amun he was not the type to shout out a challenge. No. Over the cloak's edge, she saw him frown this way and that into the gloom, then pick up a hand torch and thrust it into the flame of the larger one. As he started down the drive, holding his light aloft, she increased her sobs, leaning against the gateway as if oblivious to all the world. An instant later, the torch shone full in her face. She gasped and opened her eyes wide, letting the cloak fall as if by accident. To her satisfaction, the glowering visage on the other side of the torch relaxed into a grin of surprise.
"Well, by the Ka of my mother, it's Little Blue Eyes. Why do you weep? You were smiling last night, eh, weren't you?"
I don't know, Captain.
"Aye, you were, and at me. Now what's the trouble?"
"It's nothing."
"Then dry your tears."
He picked up the edge of her cloak and, with a man's amused tolerance, dabbed at her eyes with it. She permitted herself a brave little smile.
"There, that's better," he told her. "You're too pretty to be sad."
"You're very kind, Captain," she murmured, trying her best to blush shyly.
The sentry really did blush a little.
"Come, maid, I'm no captain. Only second sentry at a gate Pharaoh never uses."
"They keep one such as you only second sentry?"
"Aye, they do. Too young for a good duty, they keep telling me. The devil. I'll wager I can thrust a sword as smartly as those mummies at the main gate."
Perfect, thought Mara.
Young, naive, bored with his duty, and vain of his muscles.
"I'll vow you could indeed," she said admiringly. "Why, they are treating you unjustly. Youth only enhances a strong arm and a handsome appearance. No doubt they are jealous,
Reshed, son of Setek, the stonecutter.
Reshed, said Mara softly. She gazed up, wide-eyed, into his face, then allowed her lashes to sweep down against her cheek. He swallowed audibly, moving a little closer to her.
Amon, do you live in the Golden House, Blue Eyes? I never saw you before yesterday. By my Ka, you're a pretty thing.
You speak with a tongue of honey, Sentry. Aye, but what used to be pretty when I am sore at heart? Oh, Gebu, my poor Gebu.
She turned aside, sobbing again, one hand palm down on the top of her head in the attitude of mourning. As she had hoped, he extinguished the glaring torch out of respect for her grief, then stepped even closer.
Come, what ails thee, little one? Who is this Gebu?
Alas, he is my brother, alone and sick unto death in the city out yonder, while I must stay here within these walls. He is all I have in the world, and I cannot even go to nurse him.
Aye, poor little maid, who keeps thee prisoner?
I serve the Syrian princess, and must stay beside her. But she sleeps like one dead. There is no need for me at all in the night. I could go each night to Gebu if only...
Her sobs broke out afresh.
If only what?
Murmured Reshed.
He patted her shoulder. His arm went about her tentatively, casually. Still weeping, she just as casually slipped free.
If only I could pass through that gate, in secret, no one knowing or being responsible save myself. Even the sentry's back would be turned.
Now it was she who moved close to him, one hand on his forearm.
It was you I thought of, I confess it. When you smiled at me last night, you seemed so kind.
Her voice added much to the word.
But of course I was wrong. I hoped for too much. You could never let me through the gate, even with your back turned. Your captain would be angry and perhaps would punish you.
She turned away, but he drew her back, his arm no longer tentative.
Who fears the captain? Not I, pretty one.
You mean you would? That it is possible?
I mean, we might bargain a little. What would you give me if I turned my back?
Give you? But I have no gold.
He gave a low laugh, tightening his arms.
I don't want gold, little Blue Eyes.
Then, indeed, I know not. Nay, let me go!
She dodged his kiss expertly, wriggling away to shrink against the gate as if in fright.
You are too bold! Nay, come no nearer! Please, Reshed!
He stopped, laughing again.
What's the harm in a kiss?
None, perhaps. But such haste is not seemly. Why, I only this evening learned your name.
Oh, that's it. Then let us get better acquainted.
His voice held bravado, but was a little uncertain all the same. He reached for her hand and drew her. Gently, she noticed, out of the shadows.
Don't be afraid of me, he said awkwardly.
Mother of heaven, how innocent he is, thought Mara.
Standing beside him in the roadway, she smiled forgiveness.
I'm not afraid of you now. Perhaps.
She hesitated, then, as if overcome by shyness, started along the road toward the big bronze doors. He fell in eagerly beside her.
Perhaps what?
Perhaps I was only afraid of my own feelings.
Ah, were you? But when we're better acquainted?
Already he wore the expression of one diving headlong into an acre of feathers. She waited until they stood under the torchlight, then faced him, slanting a look at him from under her painted eyelids.
Why, then I might be more afraid than ever. I believe I had better bid you goodbye right now.
Goodbye? But you, I thought you...
No matter what you thought, I've changed my mind. You're an overbold young man, coaxing a maid with your honeyed words, trying to kiss her the first moment. Nay, touch me not. You wouldn't dare. I am going back to the palace. She whirled to run, but he caught her angrily about the waist.
And what of our bargain? I'll teach you to play with me, my little...
Mara suddenly stopped struggling and relaxed against him. I was only teasing. Please loosen your arm a bit. I'll bargain with you if you promise not to frighten me again. I swear I will. Don't scowl at me, please.
He stared down at her, tilting her chin up with his knuckle so that the torchlight shone full on her face.
By all the gods, I never met a maid like you,
he muttered in bewilderment.
You make a man's head swim.
Reshed, sweet Reshed, are you really going to let me through the gate?
I shouldn't.
But you will?
Not so fast. I have my price. I must see you again.
But to be sure, when I go again to visit my brother.
I want more than that, you minx. Look you, I'm off duty 3 evenings each month. Will you meet me?
Perhaps.
Aye, on my next holiday, 7 nights from now?
Perhaps, breathed Mara.
He bent suddenly to her lips, but she dodged him by an inch, lifted the great latch on the doors, and slipped through into the street beyond. Leaning in again, she lifted one hand and stroked it lingeringly down his cheek.
My thanks, dear Reshet, she whispered. I'll rap 3 times when I come home again.
Leaving him gazing after her, bemused, she hurried away into the darkness. He was gone from her mind before the doors closed. How black it was after the glare of the torch. She could barely make out the thin, tall trunks of the palms which lined the avenue, though when she looked straight up, she could see their plumy heads outlined against the stars. She must go east along the palace wall, Sheftu had said, and when the wall curved south, cross the avenue to the shop of Nefer the goldsmith. Someone would be waiting. Who, she wondered as she sped east on silent sandals. Would she have to identify herself again? And if so, how? The gods be thanked the granite-faced one had no suspicions of her. He could bait a deadly trap for her tonight if only he knew. Here was the curve of the wall. Mara peered ahead, wrapping a fold of her cloak over her head and the lower part of her face before she slipped across the deserted avenue. Gaining the shelter of a clump of trees, she saw before her the dim front of a building cut by one black rectangle, a deeply recessed doorway. Just above it, she could barely make out the hieroglyph for Nefer, traced upon the earthen bricks. Cautiously, she moved toward it. There was no sign of anyone, no sound, only that waiting black square. And if it were a trap? Anyone, anything, might be concealed yonder. She hesitated a long, reluctant moment before deciding that there was no way to try the snare save by walking into it. She cast one glance behind her, then darted into the doorway. Darkness closed over her. She stood a moment with beating heart, then began to move forward, gingerly exploring with one outstretched hand the cool, rough bricks that formed the wall. There was no sound at all, save her own uneven breathing. Was she alone, then? Expecting at any second to touch the smooth wood of a door, her hand suddenly met air instead, and after a few more paces, she realized the passage had opened out into some different place. She halted uneasily, trying to make out where she was. A breath of night air touched her cheek, accompanied by a whispered rustling overhead. She was perhaps in a courtyard, canopied by a thatch of dried palm leaves. She saw the outlines of the walls now, and here and there around them large, rounded objects, almost indistinguishable in the gloom. She was peering warily toward one when a pebble rolled behind her. She whirled. someone, something, was standing beside the wall yonder, a shape of denser black among the shadows. In panic, she shrank back toward the passage from which she had come. Then the figure moved, too. There was something familiar about that bulky outline, the set of the shoulders.
"Is it you, little one?"
came a low rumble. "Nekonk!" Almost stumbling with relief, she darted toward him.
"Hist! Not a sound made."
He materialized beside her, comfortingly solid, and she felt her arm grasped.
"This way. We'll talk later."
She had never been so glad to see anyone. She clung to him with a rush of affection that surprised even herself, feeling him an old friend, her only friend in a chancy, friendless world. This was a weary life, for all its splendor, playing with fire day after day, trusting no one, deceiving all, staking everything on the nimbleness of one's wits. For a moment, Mara longed to be back in the marketplace at Menfi, with no more on her mind than snatching a honey cake. But only for a moment. She hurried after Nekonk. "What was that place?" she whispered as they emerged into a street. "Those great humped things about the walls."
"Humped? Oh, those were furnaces, where the gold is melted. We were in Nefer's outer workshop. Here, into this alley now."
He led her across the street and into a narrow lane between dark warehouses. Stumbling over invisible rubbish, Mara spat out her annoyance, then laughed under her breath.
It's good to speak my mind when I feel like it. I've behaved so priggish of late, I'm like to smother of my own mincing and mouthing. Captain, where are we going?"
"To Thebes, to a tavern on the waterfront." "So you're weary of your fine life already, eh?"
"Not really. It's good to eat all you can hold and order slaves about, but my tongue's tired of its leash."
"I'll wager it had to wag some to get you outside those walls tonight."
"Nay, not overmuch," she evaded.
They stepped out of the alley into a jumble of low buildings, sheds, and boathouses.
"I smell the river," murmured Mara, drawing a long breath of the familiar, heady reek.
A moment later, they rounded the corner of a deserted fish stall, and the Nile lay before her, stars bobbing all along its darkly rippling length.
"Do we go across, Nekonk?"
"Aye, there's a boat waiting yonder."
He led the way southward along a steep embankment, for the river was sinking lower in its yearly rhythm, and made for a tall stone image some forgotten pharaoh had erected to his glory there on the shore. At the foot of the image, moored irreverently to one granite toe, lay a fishing punt. Nekonk grunted something into the darkness beside the statue, and a stooped figure emerged, hobbled around to the mooring rope, and silently motioned them into the boat.
"Who is he?" muttered Mara into Nekonk's ear, as the boatman's oars thrust them out into the stream.
"A papyrus cutter called Ankh, who's too old to earn his coppers in the usual way. You can trust him. He'll be here every night in case you need him."
"And will I need him often?"
"That's up to—" "Hi! I near forgot to warn you. Never mention our master's name at the Inn of the Falcon. He's known only as Sashai."
So Sheftu wore a disguise even among his followers. Sashai, the scribe.
"Does no one know him save us, then?" Mara asked incredulously.
"Only a few. The rest think him a messenger for some higher-up who's the real leader. He wants it that way, girl. Watch you don't spoil it."
They fell silent as a barge passed near them on its way to a belated mooring. Its torches threw puddles of molten gold on the black water, and the voices of two oarsmen, quarreling sleepily, drifted back on the night air as it slid away downstream. A moment later, the fishing punt was bobbing across its wake, angling slightly to the south to avoid the great dark hulk of a vessel standing far out to anchor. Beyond it rode two others, swaying gently in the current. More and more loomed up as the punt neared the wharves, until it was threading its way among hulls close crowded on every side. At last, it bumped to a halt against a ladder. The ancient Aankh held it there, while Nekank and Mara scrambled cautiously along its rocking length and up the water-soaked rungs to the dock. A few minutes later, they were in a street more crooked, dark, and evil-smelling than any in Menfi, lined with cracked walls and murky doorways, from which an occasional cloaked figure emerged to brush past them into the gloom.
"This is Cutthroat's Alley for certain, little one," muttered Nekank, whose hand was ready on his dagger. "Take care you keep your wits about you, and a good blade, too, should you pass this way alone. Here we are, through this door now."
He pushed open a creaking door, like all the rest save for the weathered wooden image of a falcon swinging from a bar above it. Within was a small courtyard, dimly lit by a flare bracketed beside another door at its far end. They made their way over rough cobblestones, past a single scrubby doom palm, to the tavern's entrance. Nekank rapped, and the door swung open. Chapter 13. Conversation at an Inn. A burst of noise and golden light flowed out around the bulky figure of a man who blocked the entrance.
"Hi! It's you, Captain!" he cried jovially, stepping back to motion Nekank and Mara past him. "Come in, come in! And who are you, my dear?"
"Her name is Blue Eye,"
grunted Nekank, before Mara could answer.
"A friend of our friend.
Is he here, Ashur?"
"Aye, aye, he's here."
The innkeeper closed the door behind them, his broad face wreathed in smiles. He was a hulk of a man, vast of girth and guileless of countenance, dressed in a rumpled shenty and huge copper ear hoops. He pattered ahead of them, the earrings bouncing and his paunch preceding him, through a tiny entryway and into a large square room, which was smoky with torchlight and smelled of beer and roasting meat. All around the walls were cubicles, divided from each other by shoulder-high partitions, but open to the room and the charcoal fire that blazed in its center in a great pottery pan. In the cubicles, kneeling on reed mats before low tables, were Ashur's customers, men, for the most part, with a scattering of women and an occasional bearded foreigner. They were eating, drinking, gambling noisily, at odd and even, or merely talking in low tones over cups of beer or date wine. One group roared drunken approval of the antics of a juggler performing his feats beside their table. At the next, two solemn old men, one fat, one thin, played an absorbed and silent game of hounds and jackals. On the other side of the room, a dancing girl swayed and postured to the jingle of her tambourine and the wail of a blind musician's flute. In the center of it all, stirring the contents of a kettle bubbling over the fire pan, stood a tiny, dried-up woman. From her sash hung a metal loop strung with ring coins, copper and silver debon. A curious necklace of shells weighted her narrow chest, and she had the brightest, most suspicious eyes Mara had ever seen. Her long spoon motionless, she watched the newcomers all the way across the room.
"My wife, Miftaya,"
puffed Ashur, noting the direction of Mara's glance.
"Wonderful woman. Her hand's at the helm here, is it not, Captain? Aye, they'd rob me blind were it not for her. By the feather, it's true. A babe of innocence, she calls me. Trusting anyone, even these rivermen."
With a breathy laugh, he dug Nekank in the ribs, then detoured around the beribboned dancing girl to head for a table in the farthest corner. As they passed, Mara glanced at the girl, whose languid movements now concealed, now revealed, the cubbyhole behind her, in which a scribe sat cross-legged before his inkstand, in earnest conversation with a shaven-headed priest. At that moment,
The scribe looked around, and the firelight fell on his face. It was Shaftu. Mara caught her breath, hesitating, but his eyes met hers only an instant, then moved calmly back to his writing block. The dancing girl whirled between them again, and Mara walked on. Her cheeks burned as she slipped past the innkeeper into the farthest cubicle and sank to her knees upon the woven mat.
"He'll be with you when it suits him, Captain,"
Ashur was saying.
"I'll fetch date wine to cool your throats."
Giving a hitch to his ample shenty, he waddled away, and Nkank lowered himself beside Mara, settling back on his heels with a grunt.
"You saw him, did you?"
"Aye, and he saw us, but little sign he gave of it."
"He's not here to dance attendance on you, little one. He has more on his mind these days than a pair of blue eyes."
The blue eyes glared at him, and he chuckled softly, shaking his head.
"Hi, I warned you to steer well around him that day on the Beetle. If you've run aground, maid, it's no fault of mine."
"I've done naught of the sort, and the devil with you. Why did that woman out yonder watch me so?"
"You mean Miftaya? Why, it's her business to watch who comes here, and the falcon lends her his eyes for the task. She'd make a fine helmsman." "Ho, Ashur, set the cups here. I'll play the host."
Nkank took the wine jug from the perspiring innkeeper, who beamed and paddled off again, his earrings bobbing. With a broad thumbnail, Nkank broke the seal, and the sharp fragrance of date wine filled Mara's nostrils. She was watching the amber liquid gurgle into a cup when a shadow fell across the table.
"Live forever, honored strangers," Shaftu said smoothly. "You wished my services? A contract written? Perhaps a list of cargoes set down accurately?"
He was leaning in the entrance to their cubicle, his inkstand under one arm, two reed pens stuck jauntily behind his ear. Even in the long robe and coarse linen headcloth of a scribe, his pose was as easy, his grace as careless, as in the court of Hatshepsut.
"Nay, no contract,"
rumbled Nkank, getting to his feet.
"But this maid here..." "Ah, a love letter, then, guaranteed to thaw the coldest heart."
He grinned down at Mara, and her retort died on her lips. As he turned to murmur something to Nkank, she struggled to regain her composure. What was it about his smile? Its warmth? Its sudden intimacy? It rushed to the head like strong wine. She was aware of nothing but him, as he stood there outlined against the noisy, torch-lit room. All day she had nerved herself for this meeting, fearing to find him again the curt and glittering stranger he had been in the Lotus Garden. Now, all in a moment, her fears had vanished. Here was no gold-hung lord, but her companion of the Beetle, warm, teasing, dangerous. Her spirits rose like a sail. With a nod of farewell, Nkank moved out of the cubicle and across the room toward a group of rivermen gaming in another corner. Shaftu slid in beside Mara.
"So you accomplished it,"
he murmured, seating himself cross-legged in the scribe's manner and setting his inkstand on the table. "Aye, but no thanks to you."
"Was it such a task?"
"Task? Why, at first I knew not even where to start. A hard master you are, Sashai. Get thee outside the walls, you say, as if it were nothing. Then away you stroll, with never another thought of it." He laughed, handing her the cup Nkank had filled, and pouring another for himself.
"But why should I think of it? I have every confidence, my lotus-eyed one, in your capacity for guile, not to say chicanery."
"Asked! I'll wager I could learn guile from you."
"Nay, pull in your claws. Were you not as you are, you'd be no use to me."
Mara sipped from her cup, feeling a glow that had nothing to do with wine. The flutist's sweet wail threaded through the jovial uproar of the tavern. Laughter was warm about her. The juggler's balls spun brighter than shooting stars. Even the dreadful message she must deliver slipped like a heft into the farthest outskirts of her mind. "You've not told me," said Sheftu, "what you think of the Inn of the Falcon."
"Ah, I like it well, save for that old woman with the beady eye out there."
"Miftaya? Nay, but she's worth all the rest put together. A marvel of a woman."
"So her husband said," remarked Mara skeptically. Sheftu regarded her with amusement.
"Perhaps it is all in the point of view. I'll admit her virtues would be less apparent to one attempting to snatch a loaf or two from under that beady eye."
"I'm done with loaf snatching, but she could watch me no closer were I after her money ring."
"Well, she has reasons. First, you are new here. Second, she is jealous as a she-leopard of every pretty maid who comes anywhere near me."
"Near you? But I thought..."
"Aye, assures her husband, but I'm her child, or so she feels. Miftaya was my nurse from infancy."
Sheftu's childhood nurse! The old woman assumed quite a different aspect in Mara's eyes, and her whole idea of the Inn of the Falcon underwent a rapid change. She had thought it a retreat Sheftu had merely chanced upon. Now she realized it must exist solely to serve his purposes.
"And ashore?" she questioned.
"He was head of my father's stables for many years, and my first companion."
Sheftu was smiling a little, remembering.
"Aye, we were fast friends. Many's the time I've ridden between his knees in my father's chariot, holding the rein ends and pretending to drive. When I did learn, it was he who taught me. I can see him now, jouncing about beside me, clutching his wig and yelling, 'Pull left, pull right!'"
Sheftu laughed outright, and Mara smiled, fascinated by this glimpse of a childhood so different from her own.
"And were you never frightened?" she asked him.
"Not I, but I'll wager Ashur was sometimes. We took a spill or two before I learned what I was doing. One of them broke my arm, and I stayed home from school while Miftaya coddled me."
"School," echoed Mara. Visions of scroll-filled shelves danced through her mind. "Did you read the ancient writings? Old tales and poetry? What was it like, your school?"
He gave her an odd look.
"Not like other schools, blue-eyed one. I fear I learned more politics than poetry."
He hesitated, playing with the amulet on his wrist, then went on.
"I was educated at the palace nurseries, along with a few other noblemen's sons. It was there I met my friend."
"So young?" exclaimed Mara. She had supposed Sheftu and the king had met at court, as youths near grown.
I was only 9 or 10 when I first saw him. He was older, of course, but he seemed to take a fancy to me. As for me, I worshipped him. He was, well, you've seen what he's like."
"Aye, I have."
Mara thought of the caged lion of a man she had met yesterday, restless, brilliant, moody, and tried to imagine him as a princeling.
"Did the queen keep guards and spies around him even then?"
Sheftu nodded, turning his wine cup in his hands.
"She's always feared him."
He hesitated, as if debating whether to go on, then added,
"She tried hard to make a priest of him, as I suppose you know."
"A priest?"
He laughed.
"The Temple of Amun is an excellent place, little one, for burying excess royalty. It would be hard to say how many younger sons of pharaohs have spent their lives tying up offerings and burning incense, instead of making things uncomfortable around the palace. However, in this case..."
There was a tiny pause. He covered it with his most engaging smile and reached for the wine jug.
"Let me fill your cup, blue-eyed one,
and summon the dancing girl. I fear I have bored you.
You mean you fear you have said too much, thought Mara, wondering how to get the rest of the story without appearing to probe for it. Her curiosity was thoroughly aroused. This had all the earmarks of a tale not intended for her ears. Therefore, she had every intention of hearing it. "It is the dancing girl who would bore me," said Shai, "but I confess I am puzzled by your story. Our friend is certainly no priest now."
"Nay, he is not," agreed Sheftu blandly.
"Strange," murmured Mara. "It is not hard to become a priest, but hard indeed to cease being one. In fact, I know of no way, unless a man disgrace his vows in some fashion."
"There was no disgrace."
Mara raised her eyebrows and waited. There was a flicker of wry amusement in Sheftu's eyes, but otherwise he made no acknowledgement of having been neatly trapped. As readily as if it were his own idea, he explained,
"It was a miracle which released him, little one, a holy miracle, clearly the work of Amun himself."
So that was it. In a rush, memory came back to Mara. There had been a time some years ago when the marketplace at Menfi had been alive with whispers of a miracle. She could recall little knots of people gathered around Theban sailors and merchants, and herself, a ragged child, squirming through their legs in an effort to hear the tale. She had heard it right enough, and had noticed that it grew more marvelous with every telling. Half awed and half disbelieving, she had ended by shrugging the whole thing off as being of less concern to her than her empty stomach.
"Ah, yes, the miracle," she murmured now. "Its fame spread even to Menfi."
"Marvelous are the ways of the gods," said Sheftu piously.
Mara smiled. She was beginning to understand, and what she understood delighted her. "A truly wonderful thing it must have been," she agreed. "It came to pass during a great festival, am I not right? Under the very nose of the queen, with all the populace looking on. The great golden image of Amun had been borne through the streets, then back again to the temple on the shoulders of the priests, while the incense rose in clouds and the people leaped for joy." Sheftu examined his wine cup with great interest. "And then, as the image of the god neared its sanctuary, behold, it turned aside, stopped before the young prince, and led him through the curtain into the Holy of Holies itself. They say he walked like one spellbound when he came forth, half fainting, to tell that Amun had named him Pharaoh. Was that the way of it, Sashai?"
"Aye," he answered solemnly. "The ways of Amun are mysterious."
There was a little pause. "And most convenient," added Mara. Sheftu put down his cup and turned to face her. His eyes were full of laughter.
"Can it be you are skeptical, little one? Surely not. It was a fine miracle, and took only a little help from the priests who carried the image."
"I thought as much," Mara said to herself. "And still you have told me nothing I did not guess already. By the feather, you can't elude the net forever, my wily fish." "So, after all," she said deliberately, "your son of the sun is naught but a clever politician." The effect was instantaneous. Sheftu's smile vanished without a trace.
"Watch thy tongue, girl. He is no politician, but a conqueror fit to rule Egypt and the world."
"But if he relies on mere tricks—"
"Listen, my pretty skeptic."
Sheftu leaned toward her, his eyes intense, his voice low and rapid. Here it came at last. He had forgotten his caution. Mara tensed herself to listen to every word.
"Think you the prince was idle those years in the temple? He spent them forging the whole priesthood into his weapon. They are ready to rise. Today, tomorrow, they need only the signal. As for the miracle, it failed to set him on the throne, but he scarce expected it to.
Hepusanbe, the High Priest, is Hatshepsut's tool. And besides, it takes more than a miracle to move that woman. Nevertheless, our trick was far from wasted.
But if no one believed,
the people believed. And they remember. Look around you.
Sheftu waved a hand toward the crowded room.
These are all rebels, loyal to the king. More than that, it forced her high and mightiness into the pretense of the regency. She waited a little too long to take Senmut's counsel and arrange for the prince to die of some mysterious ailment. After the miracle, she didn't dare. Instead, she summoned him back to the palace and made a royal prisoner of him. Too late, Bayamon! While she piles honors on that architect and his cutthroats, she fails to notice that many of the younger nobles are growing uneasy over the state of the empire.
A slow smile curved Sheftu's mouth as he settled back and reached for his cup.
I have seen to it,
he added lightly, that their uneasiness increases, and that they, too, remember that miracle. I'll wager you have, thought Mara. So that was the story. It all but took her breath away. This was no palace intrigue, but a revolution involving priesthood, nobility, and the populace, no doubt the army as well. And the whole complex affair was cupped in the palm of this prince of schemers beside her. She studied him, half in fear, half in admiration, as he drank his wine. Hatshepsut held Thutmose fast prisoner, but no one stood higher in her trust than the smooth-tongued Lord Sheftu, the most dangerous man to her in all Egypt. How had he accomplished it? Shrewd foresight, patience, deceit so sustained and perfect it was a work of art. Aye, a masterpiece, thought Mara, remembering his airy disregard of court etiquette yesterday, his lounging arrogance. Yet there was a far different Sheftu, the dark and lonely figure she had seen silhouetted against the flaming sky one evening on the Beetle. She felt close to him suddenly. For all his insouciance, for all his gold, he lived a life as precarious as her own. And if he obeyed those terrible instructions she must give him tonight. As he set down his cup, she turned away, pushing the thought hastily from her mind. No need to think of those instructions yet. No need to think of them at all. Remember, Mara, he is your enemy. And have you not bested him at his own game tonight? Take heart, though he conceals it better. He's no more immune to you than Rashed. His first words served to verify her confidence. What is it about thee, maid, that loosens my tongue at both ends? By the beard of Ptah, I've done more talking tonight than— Do you not talk to others so?
Nay, I do not!
He sounded annoyed to her mischievous delight. She quoted blandly from an ancient proverb. Be not arrogant because of thy knowledge. Goodly discourse is more hidden than the precious green stone, and yet it is found with slave girls over the millstones.
Silence, he quoted back at her dryly, is more valuable than the tef-tef plant. See that you watch your own tongue. Scarce a handful even know who I am, and it is better they do not. Oh, a few know the plans, of course. Nefer the goldsmith, the priest I was talking to when you arrived, ashore, a few nobles, Nekunk.
And I, reminded Mara.
I, and now you.
He had leaned forward, his profile half hidden from her by the bulk of his shoulder, and he was toying with one of his reed pens, turning it over and over in his long brown fingers.
I'll wager I live to regret that, he added.
Mara pressed close to him. Sashai, do you not trust me? He turned with a half-smile and a glance from his long eyes that made her heart beat faster.
My lovely Mara, he said softly, I don't trust you as far as tomorrow.
She jerked away, her confidence suddenly in tatters. Why? So you have said before. If it is true, you have great faith in the gods.
Nay, I have great faith in your reluctance to go back to loaf-snatching.
He was laughing at her now. All in an instant, he had retreated behind that facade of charming banter, where neither thrusts nor wiles could reach him. Furious, she struggled for a manner as careless. How had she ever imagined she felt close to this enigma? He had only made a fool of her. Or had he really opened his mind to her in a moment of earnestness, and then regretted it? One thing was certain. He wished to remind her, and perhaps himself, of their precise relationship. Loaf-snatching, gutter-snipe. Very well, so be it. She had herself in hand by the time he spoke again.
Never mind that. Let us say you are one of the gambles I've dared to take. So far, it's naught but exhilarating. Now tell me, how did you swindle your way through those gates tonight?
She shrugged. With a languishing glance and a few tears, there's a young sentry who thinks I'm smitten with him. A handsome young sentry, she added.
Indeed, how pleasant for you. But did tears alone convince him he should let you through the gate?
He would much rather have kissed me, but I consented to a bargain.
Oh, very good. And you will dangle this bargain like a sweetmeat until the fellow has served his purpose. Excellent. It might last for months.
And again, it mightn't, retorted Mara sharply. The conversation was not going as she wished. Even a sentry's patience may be tried too far, you know. This one's young and ardent. What if his patience ends? Sheftu eased one elbow onto the table, rested his cheek in his hand, and regarded her blandly. His long eyes were brimming with amusement.
You'll think of something, he said.
The devil take you, thought Mara. Aloud, she snapped, or perhaps I shall simply keep the bargain. There was a little silence. Sheftu straightened, took a sip of his wine, and set the mug down with care.
Not, he said, unless you wish me to feed him to the crocodiles, bit by bit.
Mara's mouth dropped open, but before she could speak, another voice, soft and persuasive as the flute's tone, slid between them.
A lover's quarrel, friend Sashay?
It was the juggler, standing in the entrance to their cubicle. He had a crooked shoulder, Mara noticed, and a smile of curious charm in a twisted, ugly face. His glittering balls were momentarily at rest in the curve of his arm, save for three which traced a shining, stealthy little circle above his right hand, as if they had a life of their own.
Nay, Sahure, answered Chef too easily, we never quarrel, nor are we in love.
The first was a lie, thought Mara. But the second? She was still tingling with surprise over the remark about Rashed and the crocodiles. Glancing impatiently at Sahure, she found her gaze caught and held by a pair of dark, cynical eyes, profoundly old, profoundly weary, as if they had long ago seen everything and found value in nothing.
And may I know this enchanting stranger whom you claim you do not love?
Went on the juggler.
If you speak truth, friend Sashai, then your heart must be a mysterious thing, no more flesh and blood than one of my gilded balls here. Is it not so, blue-eyed one?
I know not, juggler, murmured Mara. She was half attracted, half repelled by this Sahure, with his young, beguiling voice and his old, old eyes.
Nay, call me not juggler, but friend. My heart is no gilded plaything.
The balls rose in a golden fountain above his hand, then resumed their steady circling, but his gaze never left Mara's face.
Have you orders for me, master?
Not tonight.
I am desolate. Would there were cause for me to linger in the light of this little one's countenance. Where did you say you discovered her?
I failed to say,
answered Sheftu dryly. Sahure's smile curved beneath his ancient eyes.
Aye, so you did. But she is not of Thebes, for I have seen high and low, princesses and slaves, and who could forget her? She was not among them. Mother Nile has borne her to us from another shore, no doubt, as she bears the gift of mud which makes Egypt great. Will you permit my poor efforts to entertain you, face of the lily?
Sheftu shook his head.
Begone, Sahure. Others crave your talents. While you crave to mend the quarrel which was not a quarrel with this lovely one who is not beloved.
The three balls leaped up, dazzling, and with a subtle twist of his body, Sahure brought all the others into play.
In that case, I shall leave you, flower of grace, though not forever. May thy ka endure, and thy shadow seek the light.
The soft voice trailed away as he turned, letting his gaze slide off Mara at last. The golden cataract of balls switched suddenly to a triangle, then to a pattern of brilliant intricacy before resolving once more into a circle. In a frame of moving light, the juggler glided away across the floor.
Mother of the gods, breathed Mara. Is he man or Heft?
Sheftu laughed. Sahure dwells in a dark land, I grant you, but there's no harm in him. I found him very useful.
You mean you trust him with your secrets? Great Amun, he'd betray his own Ka, I believe.
Nay, he's loyal. In any case, he knows little, not even who I am. I admit he tries his best to find out. It's just curiosity.
Perhaps, muttered Mara. She frowned. This talk of loyalty and betrayal had made her aware of much she had forgotten, and would rather have gone on forgetting. She twirled her wine mug, watching the play of golden balls on the other side of the room. Why had the juggler tried so hard to discover where she came from and who she was? Already, in his poetic babblings of Mother Nile, he had arrived at one answer very shrewdly, and his cynical eyes had never moved from her. He would know her next time they met, that was certain. Where would it be? Perhaps in the presence of Lord Nahere? She shivered and took a sip of the wine, trying to dismiss the notion as impossible. But her thoughts were restless now, leaping back to that message she had yet to deliver. It was warm and pleasant here, with the good smell of meat and the torchlight flooding the room with smoky gold. But outside the night was waning. There was still the river to cross, the dark alleys and the silent streets to find her way through, the stealthy taps on Reshad's gate. She set down her cup and spoke in a low voice. It grows late, Sashai. I must leave. And before that...
Before that, you must tell me what I must know. Aye, it is time made, but not here,
he added, with a glance at the trio of Libyan traders noisily taking possession of the next cubicle.
Come.
He rose and drew her to her feet. Picking up her cloak, she followed him out across the room. We are really enemies, she reminded herself. I care not for what happens to him. Nekonk stood up as they passed by him, detached himself from his companions, and drifted toward the door. Otherwise, no notice was taken of them. The two old men were setting up their board for another game of hounds and jackals. Ashur was hurrying toward the priest's table with a steaming platter. The dancing girl was passing her tambourine among a group of hilarious artisans in the corner. As they reached the fire pan, where the innkeeper's wife was dishing up more meat, Sheftu paused and spoke quietly.
Miftaya.
She straightened. Sheftu handed her a few debon, like any man paying for his wine.
This maid is one of us,
he murmured.
She is free to come and go here at any time.
The old woman's eyes moved to Mara. She nodded grudgingly, then slipped the coins onto her money ring and turned back to the fire.
In another moment, Sheftu was holding open the tavern's outer door. The moon had risen now, a faded sliver in the vast, dark sky, and the night had grown chill. Mara wrapped her cloak around her as she followed Sheftu into the darkest corner of the courtyard. Yonder, by the gate, was a dim hulk which must be Nekonk.
"Now, tell me."
Sheftu had lowered his voice almost to nothing.
"Was my Pharaoh well?"
"Aye."
"You gave him my message?"
"Aye, I gave it."
"Well, go on. What did he say?"
She roused herself, trying to shake off a feeling of oppression. "He seemed overjoyed. He said you must be the great magician himself." She could feel Sheftu's deep pleasure.
"The gods were with me on that venture. I've not been idle since. When you see him next, say to him that two of the uncertain ones, he of the fan and he of the feather, have come into our house. Do you have that clear?"
"He of the fan and he of the feather," echoed Mara mechanically. "Aye, I have it."
"Good. Now for my orders."
As she hesitated, he frowned impatiently.
"Come, speak. We have not all night."
"He says you must find more gold."
"I know that. I've promised bribes already I cannot pay. But where? Did he... What's amiss, maid?"
Sheftu bent closer, scanning her face. Then he slowly straightened.
"Is it bad, then?"
"Aye, it is bad. It is so dread a thing, I dare not speak it. Ah, I beg thee, Sheftu, disobey this time. Thy prince has no right to demand such a crime of thee, no matter—"
"Hush!"
He clapped a hand over her mouth, darting an angry glance about the courtyard.
"Would you have all Thebes here? Now cease thy babbling and tell me."
"Nay, I'll not. Do not ask me, Sheftu. It is better thus. I vow it is better. You should never—" He swept her forcibly against him, doubling her wrist behind her in a grip that made her wince.
"You forget yourself,"
he said in a low, harsh voice.
"You are not judge, but messenger."